saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Section 5 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 1. By Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 2, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 5. Next morning, the rope dancers, not without much parade and bustle, having gone away, Mignon immediately appeared and came into the parlour as Wilhelm and Laertes were busy fencing. "Where hast thou been hid?" said Wilhelm in a friendly tone. "Thou hast given us a great deal of anxiety." The child looked at him and answered nothing. "Thou art ours now," cried Laertes. "We have bought thee." "For how much?" inquired the child, quite coolly. "For 100 ducats," said the other. "Pay them again and thou art free."
"Is that very much?" she asked.
"Oh, yes. Thou must now be a good child."
"I will try," she said.
From that moment she observed strictly what services the waiter had to do for both her friends, and after next day she would not any more let him enter the room. She persisted in doing everything herself, and accordingly went through her duties, slowly indeed, and sometimes awkwardly, yet completely, and with the greatest care. She was frequently observed going to a basin of water and washing her face with such diligence and violence that she almost wore the skin from her cheeks, till Laertes, by dint of questions and reproofs, learned that she was striving by all means to get the paint from her skin, and that, in her zealous endeavours towards this object, she had mistaken the redness produced by rubbing for the most obdurate dye. They set her right on this point, and she ceased her efforts. After which, having come again to her natural state, she exhibited a fine brown complexion, beautiful, though sparingly intermingled with red. The siren charms of Filina, the mysterious presence of the child, produced more impression on our friend than he liked to confess. He passed several days in that strange society, endeavouring to elude self-reproaches by a diligent practice of fencing and dancing, accomplishments which he believed might not again be put within his reach so conveniently. It was with great surprise and not without a certain satisfaction that he one day observed Herr Melina and his wife alight at the inn. After the first glad salutation, they inquired about the lady manager and the other actors, and learned with astonishment and terror that the lady manager had long since gone away, and her actors, to a very few, dispersed themselves about the country. This couple, subsequently to their marriage, in which, as we know, our friend did his best to serve them, had been travelling about in various quarters, seeking an engagement, without finding any, and had at last been directed to this little town by some persons who met them on their journey, and said there was a good theatre in the place. Melina by no means pleased the lively Laertes when introduced to him, any more than his wife did Filina. Both heartily wished to be rid of these newcomers, and Wilhelm could inspire them with no favourable feelings on the subject, though he more than once assured them that the Melinas were very worthy people. Indeed, the previous merry life of our three adventurers was interfered with by this extension of their society in more ways than one. Melina had taken up his quarters in the inn where Filina stayed, and he very soon began a system of cheapening and higgling. He would have better lodging, more sumptuous diet, and readier attendance for a smaller charge. In a short while the landlord and waiter showed very rueful looks, for whereas the others, to get pleasantly along, had expressed no discontent with anything, and paid instantly, that they might avoid thinking longer of payment, Melina now insisted on regulating every meal and investigating its contents beforehand, a species of service for which Filina named him, without scruple, a ruminating animal. Yet more did the merry girl hate Melina's wife. Frau Melina was a young woman not without culture, but woefully defective in soul and spirit. She could declaim not badly and kept declaiming constantly, but it was easy to observe that her performances were little more than recitations of words. She laboured a few detached passages, but never could express the feeling of the whole. Withal, however, she was seldom disagreeable to anyone, especially to men. On the contrary, people who enjoyed her acquaintance commonly ascribed to her a fine understanding, for she was what might be called a kind of spiritual chameleon or taker-on. Any friend whose favour she had need of she could flatter with particular adroitness, could give in to his ideas so long as she could understand them,
and when they went beyond her own horizon, could hail with ecstasy such new and brilliant visions. She understood well when to speak and when to keep silence, and, though her disposition was not spiteful, she could spy out with great expertness where another's weak side lay. Chapter 6. Melina, in the meantime, had been making strict inquiry about the wrecks of the late theatrical establishment. The wardrobe, as well as decorations, had been pawned with some traders, and a notary had been empowered, under certain conditions, to dispose of them by sale, should purchases occur. Melina wished to see this ware, and he took Wilhelm with him. No sooner was the room opened than our friend felt towards its contents a kind of inclination, which he would not confess to himself. Sad as was the state of the blotched and tarnished decorations, little showy as the Turkish and pagan garments, the old farce coats for men and women, the cowls for enchanters, priests and Jews might be, he was not able to exclude the feeling that the happiest moments of his life had been spent in a similar magazine of frippery. Could Melina have seen into his heart, he would have urged him more pressingly to lay out a sum of money in liberating these scattered fragments, in furbishing them up, and again combining them into a beautiful whole. "What a happy man could I be," cried Melina, "had I but 200 crowns to get into my hands for a beginning these fundamental necessaries of a theatre. How soon should I get up a little playhouse that would draw contributions from the town and neighbourhood and maintain us all?" Wilhelm was silent. They left these treasures of the stage to be again locked up, and both went away in a reflective mood. Thenceforth Melina talked of nothing else but projects and plans for setting up a theatre, and gaining profit by it. He tried to interest Filina and Laertes in his schemes, and proposals were made to Wilhelm about advancing money and taking them as his security. On this occasion Wilhelm first clearly perceived that he was lingering too long here. He excused himself and set about making preparations for departure. In the meantime, Mignon's form and manner of existence were growing more attractive to him every day. In her whole system of proceedings there was something very singular. She never walked up or down the stairs, but jumped. She would spring along by the railing, and before you were aware would be sitting quietly above upon the landing. Wilhelm had observed also that she had a different sort of salutation for each individual. For himself, it had of late been with her arms crossed upon her breast. Often for the whole day she was mute. At times she answered various questions more freely, yet always strangely, so that you could not determine whether it was caused by shrewd sense or ignorance of the language, for she spoke in broken German interlaced with French and Italian. In Wilhelm's service she was indefatigable, and up before the sun. On the other hand, she vanished early in the evening, went to sleep in a little room upon the bare floor, and could not by any means be induced to take a bed or even a paillasse. He often found her washing herself. Her clothes, too, were kept scrupulously clean, though nearly all about her was quilted 2 or 3 plies thick. Wilhelm was moreover told that she went every morning early to hear Mass. He followed her on one occasion, and saw her kneeling down with a rosary in a corner of the church, and praying devoutly. She did not observe him, and he returned home, forming many a conjecture about this appearance, yet unable to arrive at any probable conclusion. A new application from Melina for a sum of money to redeem the often-mentioned stage apparatus caused Wilhelm to think more seriously than ever about setting off. He proposed writing to his people, who for a long time had heard no tidings of him, by the very earliest post. He accordingly commenced a letter to Werner, and had advanced a considerable way with the history of his adventures, in recounting which he had more than once unintentionally swerved a little from the truth, when to his vexation and surprise he observed, upon the back of his sheet, some verses which he had been copying from his album for Madame Melina. Out of humour at this mistake, he tore the paper in pieces, and put off repeating his confession till the next post-day. Chapter 7. Our party was now again collected, and Filina, who always kept a sharp lookout on every horse or carriage that passed by, exclaimed with great eagerness, "Our pedant! Here comes our dearest pedant! Who the deuce is it he has with him?" Speaking thus, she beckoned at the window, and the vehicle drew up. A woeful-looking genius, whom by his shabby coat of greyish-brown and his ill-conditioned lower garments you must have taken for some unprosperous preceptor, of the sort that moulder in our universities, now descended from the carriage, and taking off his hat to salute Filina, discovered an ill-powdered but yet very stiff periwig, while Filina threw 100 kisses of the hand toward him. As Filina's chief enjoyment lay in loving one class of men and being loved by them, so there was a second and hardly inferior satisfaction wherewith she entertained herself as frequently as possible, and this consisted in hoodwinking and passing jokes upon the other class, whom at such moments she happened not to love, all which she could accomplish in a very sprightly style. Amid the flourish which she made in receiving this old friend, no attention was bestowed upon the rest who followed him. Yet among the party were an oldish man and two young girls, whom Wilhelm thought he knew. Accordingly it turned out that he had often seen them all, some years ago, in a company then playing in his native town. The daughters had grown since that period. The old man was a little altered. He commonly enacted those good-hearted, boisterous old gentlemen, whom the German theatre is never without, and whom in common life one also frequently enough falls in with. For as it is the character of our countrymen to do good, and cause it, without pomp or circumstance, so they seldom consider that there is likewise a mode of doing what is right with grace and dignity. More frequently, indeed, they yield to the spirit of contradiction, and fall into the error of deforming their dearest virtue by a surly mode of putting it in practice. Such parts our actor could play very well, and he played them so often and exclusively that he had himself taken up the same turn of proceeding in his ordinary life. On recognizing him, Wilhelm was seized with a strong commotion, for he recollected how often he had seen this man on the stage with his beloved Mariana. He still heard him scolding, still heard the small, soothing voice with which in many characters she had to meet his rugged temper. The first anxious question put to the strangers, whether they had heard of any situation in their travels, was answered, alas, with no, and to complete the information it was further added that all the companies they had fallen in with were not only supplied with actors, but many of them were afraid lest, on account of the approaching war, they should be forced to separate. Old Boisterous, with his daughter, moved by spleen and love of change, had given up an advantageous engagement. Then, meeting with the pedant by the way, they had hired a carriage to come hither, whereas they found good counsel was still dear, needful to have, and difficult to get. The time while the rest were talking very keenly of their circumstances, Wilhelm spent in thought. He longed to speak in private with the old man. He wished and feared to hear of Mariana, and felt the greatest disquietude. The pretty looks of the stranger damsels could not call him from his dream, but a war of words which now arose awakened his attention. It was Friedrich, the fair-haired boy who used to attend Filina, stubbornly refusing on this occasion to cover the table and bring up dinner. "I engaged to serve you," he cried, "but not to wait on everybody." They fell into a hot contest. Filina insisted that he should do his duty, and as he obstinately refused, she told him plainly he might go about his business. "You think perhaps I cannot leave you," cried he sturdily, then went to pack up his bundle, and soon hastily quitted the house. "Go, Mignon," said Filina, "and get us what we want. Tell the waiter, and help him to attend us." Mignon came before Wilhelm, and asked in her laconic way, "Shall I? May I?" To which Wilhelm answered, "Do all the lady bids thee, child." She accordingly took charge of everything, and waited on the guests the whole evening, with the utmost carefulness. After dinner Wilhelm proposed to have a walk with the old man alone. Succeeding in this, after many questions about his late wanderings, the conversation turned upon the former company, and Wilhelm hazarded a question touching Mariana. "Do not speak to me of that despicable creature," cried the old man. "I have sworn to think of her no more." Terrified at this speech, Wilhelm felt still more embarrassed, as the old man proceeded to vituperate her fickleness and wantonness. Most gladly would our friend have broken off the conversation, but now it was impossible. He was obliged to undergo the whole tumultuous effusions of this strange old gentleman. "I am ashamed," continued he, "that I felt such a friendship for her. Yet had you known the girl better, you would excuse me. She was so pretty, so natural and good, so pleasing, in every sense so tolerable, I could never have supposed that ingratitude and impudence were to prove the chief features of her character." Wilhelm had nerved himself to hear the worst of her, when all at once he observed with astonishment that the old man's tones grew milder, his voice faltered, and he took out his handkerchief to dry the tears, which at last began to trickle down his cheeks. "What is the matter with you?" cried Wilhelm. "What is it that suddenly so changes the current of your feelings? Conceal it not from me. I take a deeper interest in the fate of this girl than you suppose. Only tell me all." "I have not much to say," replied the old man, again taking up his earnest, angry tone. I have suffered more from her than I shall ever forgive. She had always a kind of trust in me. I loved her as my own daughter. Indeed, while my wife lived, I had formed a resolution to take the creature to my own house, and save her from the hands of that old crone, from whose guidance I boded no good. But my wife died, and the project went to nothing. About the end of our stay in your native town, it is not quite 3 years ago, I noticed a visible sadness about her. I questioned her, but she evaded me. At last we set out on our journey. She travelled in the same coach with me, and I soon observed, what she herself did not long deny, that she was with child, and suffering the greatest terror lest our manager might turn her off. In fact, in a short while he did make the discovery, immediately threw up her contract, which at any rate was only for 6 weeks, paid off her arrears, and in spite of all entreaties left her behind in the miserable inn of a little village. "Devil take all wanton jilts," cried the old man with a splenetic tone, "and especially this one, that has spoiled me so many hours of my life. Why should I keep talking how I myself took charge of her, what I did for her, what I spent on her, how in absence I provided for her? I would rather throw my purse into the ditch and spend my time in nursing mangy whelps than ever more bestow the smallest care on such a thing. Sure! At first I got letters of thanks, notice of places she was staying at, and finally no word at all, not even an acknowledgment for the money I had sent to pay the expenses of her lying in. Oh, the treachery and the fickleness of women are rightly matched, to get a comfortable living for themselves, and to give an honest fellow many heavy hours. Chapter 8. Wilhelm's feelings on returning home after this conversation may be easily conceived. All his old wounds had been torn up afresh, and the sentiment that Mariana was not wholly unworthy of his love had again been brought to life. The interest the old man had shown about her fate, the praises he gave her against his will, displayed her again in all her attractiveness. Nay, even the bitter accusations brought against her contained nothing that could lower her in Wilhelm's estimation, for he as well as she was guilty in all her aberrations. Nor did even her final silence seem greatly blamable. It rather inspired him with mournful thoughts. He saw her as a frail, ill-succoured mother, wandering helplessly about the world, wandering perhaps with his own child. What he knew and what he knew not awoke in him the painfulest emotions. Mignon had been waiting for him. She lighted him upstairs. On setting down the light, she begged he would allow her that evening to compliment him with a piece of her art. He would rather have declined this, particularly as he knew not what it was, but he had not the heart to refuse anything this kind creature wished. After a little while she again came in. She carried below her arm a little carpet, which she then spread out upon the floor. Wilhelm said she might proceed. She thereupon brought four candles and placed one upon each corner of the carpet. A little basket of eggs, which she next carried in, made her purpose clearer. Carefully measuring her steps, she then walked to and fro on the carpet, spreading out the eggs in certain figures and positions. Which done, she called in a man that was waiting in the house, and could play on the violin. He retired with his instrument into a corner. She tied a band about her eyes, gave a signal, and, like a piece of wheelwork set a-going, she began moving the same instant as the music, accompanying her beats and the notes of the tune with the strokes of a pair of castanets. Lightly, nimbly, quickly, and with hair's-breadth accuracy, she carried on the dance. She skipped so sharply and surely along between the eggs, and trod so closely down beside them, that you would have thought every instant she must trample one of them in pieces, or kick the rest away in her rapid turns. By no means. She touched no one of them, though winding herself through their mazes with all kinds of steps, wide and narrow, nay, even with leaps, and at last half-kneeling. Constant as the movement of a clock, she ran her course, and the strange music, at each repetition of the tune, gave a new impulse to the dance, recommencing and again rushing off as at first. Wilhelm was quite led away by this singular spectacle. He forgot his cares. He followed every movement of the dear little creature, and felt surprised to see how finely her character unfolded itself as she proceeded in the dance. Rigid, sharp, cold, vehement, and in soft postures, stately rather than attractive, such was the light in which it showed her. At this moment he experienced at once all the emotions he had ever felt for Mignon. He longed to incorporate this forsaken being with his own heart, to take her in his arms, and with a father's love to awaken in her the joy of existence. The dance being ended, she rolled the eggs together softly with her foot into a little heap, left none behind, harmed none, then placed herself beside it, taking the bandage from her eyes, and concluding her performance with a little bow. Wilhelm thanked her for having executed so prettily and unexpectedly a dance he had long wished to see. He patted her, was sorry she had tired herself so much. He promised her a new suit of clothes, to which she vehemently replied, "Thy colour." This too he promised her, though not well knowing what she meant by it. She then lifted up the eggs, took the carpet under her arm, asked if he wanted anything further, and skipped out of the room. The musician, being questioned, said that for some time she had taken much trouble in often singing over the tune of this dance, the well-known fandango, to him, and training him till he could play it accurately. For his labour she had likewise offered him some money, which, however, he would not accept. Chapter 9. After a restless night, which our friend spent, sometimes waking, sometimes oppressed with unpleasant dreams, seeing Marianna now in all her beauty, now in woeful case, at one time with a child on her arm, then soon bereaved of it, the morning had scarcely dawned when Mignon entered with a tailor. She brought some grey cloth and blue taffeta, signifying in her own way that she wished to have a new jacket and sailor's trousers, such as she had seen the boys of the town wear, with blue cuffs and tiers. Since the loss of Marianna, Wilhelm had laid aside all gay colours. He had used himself to grey, the garment of the shades, and only perhaps a sky-blue lining or little collar of that dye in some degree enlivened his sober garb. Mignon, eager to wear his colours, hurried on the tailor, who engaged to have his work soon ready. The exercise in dancing and fencing which our friend took this day with Laertes did not prosper in their hands. Indeed, it was soon interrupted by Melina, who came to show them circumstantially how a little company was now of itself collected, sufficient to exhibit plays in abundance. He renewed the proposal that Wilhelm should advance a little money for setting them in motion, which, however, Wilhelm still declined. Ere long, Felina and the girls came in, racketing and laughing as usual. They had now devised a fresh excursion, for change of place and objects was a pleasure after which they always longed. To eat daily in a different spot was their highest wish. On this occasion they proposed a sail. The boat in which they were to fall down the pleasant windings of the river had already been engaged by the pedant. Felina urged them on. The party did not linger, and was soon on board. "What shall we take to now?" said Felina, when all had placed themselves upon the benches. "The readiest thing," replied Laertes, "were for us to extemporize a play. Let each take a part that suits his character, and we shall see how we get along." "Excellent," said Wilhelm. "In a society where there is no dissimulation, but where each without disguise pursues the bent of his own humour, elegance and satisfaction cannot long continue. And where dissimulation always reigns, they do not enter at all. It will not be amiss, then, that we take up dissimulation to begin with, and then, behind our masks, be as candid as we please." "Yes," said Laertes, "it is on this account that one goes on so pleasantly with women. They never show themselves in their natural form." "That is to say," replied Madame Melina, "they are not so vain as men, who conceive themselves to be always amiable enough, just as nature has produced them." In the meantime the river led them between pleasant groves and hills, between gardens and vineyards, and the young women, especially Madame Melina, expressed their rapture at the landscape. The latter even began to recite, in solemn style, a pretty poem of the descriptive sort, upon a similar scene of nature. But Felina interrupted her with the proposal of a law, that no one should presume to speak of any inanimate object. On the other hand, she zealously urged on their project of an extempore play. Old Boisterous was to be a half-pay officer, Laertes a fencing master, taking his vacation, the pedant a Jew, she herself would act a Tyrolese, leaving to the rest to choose characters according to their several pleasures. They would suppose themselves to be a party of total strangers to each other, who had just met on board a merchant ship. She immediately began to play her part with the Jew, and a universal cheerfulness diffused itself among them. They had not sailed far when the skipper stopped in his course, asking permission of the company to take in a person standing on the shore, who had made a sign to him. "That is just what we needed," cried Felina. "A chance passenger was wanting to complete the travelling party." A handsome man came on board, whom, by his dress and his dignified mien, you might have taken for a clergyman. He saluted the party, who thanked him in their own way, and soon made known to him the nature of their game. The stranger immediately engaged to act the part of a country parson, which in fact he accomplished in the adroitest manner, to the admiration of all, now admonishing, now telling stories, showing some weak points, yet never losing their respect. In the meantime, every one who had made a false step in his part, or swerved from his character, had been obliged to forfeit a pledge. Filina had gathered them with the greatest care, and especially threatened the reverend gentleman with many kisses, though he himself had never been at fault. Melina, on the other hand, was completely fleeced. Shirt buttons, buckles, every movable about his person was in Filina's hands. He was trying to enact an English traveller, and could not by any means get into the spirit of his part. Meanwhile the time had passed away very pleasantly. Each had strained his fancy and his wit to the utmost, and each had garnished his part with agreeable and entertaining jests. Thus comfortably occupied, they reached the place where they meant to pass the day, and Wilhelm, going out to walk with the clergyman, as both from his appearance and late character he persisted in naming him, soon fell into an interesting conversation. "I think this practice," said the stranger, "very useful among actors, and even in the company of friends and acquaintances. It is the best mode of drawing men out of themselves, and leading them by a circuitous path back into themselves again. It should be a custom with every troupe of players to practice in this manner, and the public would assuredly be no loser if every month an unwritten piece were brought forward, in which, of course, the players had prepared themselves by several rehearsals." "One should not then," replied our friend, "consider an extempore piece as, strictly speaking, composed on the spur of the moment, but as a piece of which the plan, action, and division of the scenes were given, the filling up of all this being left to the player." "Quite right," said the stranger, "and in regard to this very filling up, such a piece, were the players once trained to these performances, would profit greatly. Not in regard to the mere words, it is true, for by a careful selection of these the studious writer may certainly adorn his work, but in regard to the gestures, looks, exclamations, and everything of that nature, in short, to the mute and half-mute play of the dialogue, which seems by degrees fading away among us altogether. There are indeed some players in Germany whose bodies figure what they think and feel, who by their silence, their delays, their looks, their slight graceful movements, can prepare the audience for a speech, and by a pleasant sort of pantomime combine the pauses of the dialogue with the general whole. But such a practice as this, cooperating with a happy natural turn, and training it to compete with the author, is far from being so habitual as, for the comfort of play-going people, were to be desired." "But will not a happy natural turn," said Wilhelm, "as the first and last requisite, of itself conduct the player, like every other artist, nay, perhaps every other man, to the lofty mark he aims at?" "The first and the last, the beginning and the end, it may well be. But in the middle many things will still be wanting to an artist, if instruction, and early instruction too, have not previously made that of him which he was meant to be. And perhaps for the man of genius it is worse in this respect than for the man possessed of only common capabilities. The one may much more easily be misinstructed, and be driven far more violently into false courses than the other." "But," said Wilhelm, "will not genius save itself, not heal the wounds which itself has inflicted?" "Only to a very small extent, and with great difficulty," said the other, "or perhaps not at all. Let no one think that he can conquer the first impressions of his youth. If he has grown up in enviable freedom, surrounded with beautiful and noble objects, in constant intercourse with worthy men, if his masters have taught him what he needed first to know, for comprehending more easily what followed, if he has never learned anything which he requires to unlearn, if his first operations have been so guided that, without altering any of his habits, he can more easily produce what is excellent in future, then such a one will lead a purer, more perfect and happier life than another man who has wasted the force of his youth in opposition and error. A great deal is said and written about education, yet I meet with very few who can comprehend and transfer to practice this simple yet vast idea which includes within itself all others connected with the subject." "That may well be true," said Wilhelm, "for the generality of men are limited enough in their conceptions to suppose that every other should be fashioned by education, according to the pattern of themselves. Happy, then, are those whom fate takes charge of, and educates according to their several natures." "Fate," said the other, smiling, "is an excellent but most expensive schoolmaster. In all cases, I would rather trust to the reason of a human tutor. Fate, for whose wisdom I entertain all imaginable reverence, often finds in chance, by which it works, an instrument not overmanageable. At least the latter very seldom seems to execute precisely and accurately what the former had determined. "You seem to express a very singular opinion," said Wilhelm. "Not at all," replied the other. "Most of what happens in the world confirms my opinion. Do not many incidents at their commencement show some mighty purport, and generally terminate in something paltry?"
"You mean to jest."
"And as to what concerns the individual man," pursued the other, "is it not so with this likewise? Suppose fate had appointed one to be a good player, and why should it not provide us with good players as well as other good things? Chance would perhaps conduct the youth into some puppet show, where at such an early age he could not help taking interest in what was tasteless and despicable, reckoning insipidities endurable or even pleasing, and thus corrupting and misdirecting his primary impressions, impressions which can never be effaced, and whose influence, in spite of all our efforts, clings to us in some degree to the very last."
"What makes you think of puppet shows?" said Wilhelm, not without some consternation.
"It was an accidental instance. If it does not please you, we shall take another. Suppose fate had appointed any one to be a great painter, and it pleased chance that he should pass his youth in sooty huts, in barns and stables. Do you think that such a man would ever be enabled to exalt himself to purity, to nobleness, to freedom of soul? The more keenly he may in his youth have seized on the impure, and tried in his own manner to ennoble it, the more powerfully in the remainder of his life will it be revenged on him, because, while he was endeavouring to conquer it, his whole being has become inseparably combined with it. Whoever spends his early years in mean and pitiful society, though at an after period he may have the choice of better, will yet constantly look back with longing toward that which he enjoyed of old, and which has left its impression blended with the memory of all his young and unreturning pleasures." From conversation of this sort, it is easy to imagine, the rest of the company had gradually withdrawn. Filina, in particular, had stepped aside at the very outset. Wilhelm and his comrade now rejoined them by a cross-path. Filina brought out her forfeits, and they had to be redeemed in many different ways, during which business the stranger, by the most ingenious devices, and by his frank participation in their sports, recommended himself much to all the party, and particularly to the ladies. And thus, amid joking, singing, kissing, and railleries of all sorts, the hours passed away in the most pleasant manner. End of section 5. Section 6 of Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Volume 1, by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, translated by Thomas Carlyle. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 2, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Chapter 10. When our friends began to think of going home, they looked about them for their clergyman, but he had vanished and was nowhere to be found. "It is not polite in the man, who otherwise displayed good breeding," said Madame Melina, "to desert a company that welcomed him so kindly, without taking leave." "I have all the time been thinking," said Laertes, "where I can have seen this singular man before. I fully intended to ask him about it at parting."
"I too had the same feeling," said Wilhelm, "and certainly I should not have let him go till he had told us something more about his circumstances. I am much mistaken if I have not ere now spoken with him somewhere."
"And you may in truth," said Filina, "be mistaken there. This person seems to have the air of an acquaintance, because he looks like a man, and not like Jack or Kit."
"What is this?" said Laertes. "Do not we too look like men?"
"I know what I am saying," cried Filina, "and if you cannot understand me, never mind. In the end my words will be found to require no commentary." Two coaches now drove up. All praised the attention of Laertes, who had ordered them. Filina, with Madame Melina, took her place opposite to Wilhelm. The rest bestowed themselves as they best could. Laertes rode back on Wilhelm's horse, which had likewise been brought out. Filina was scarcely seated in the coach when she began to sing some pretty songs, and gradually led the conversation to some stories, which she said might be successfully treated in the form of dramas. By this cunning turn she very soon put her young friend into his finest humour. From the wealth of his living imaginative store he forthwith constructed a complete play, with all its acts, scenes, characters, and plots. It was thought proper to insert a few catches and songs. They composed them, and Filina, who entered into every part of it, immediately fitted them with well-known tunes, and sang them on the spot.
It was one of her beautiful, most beautiful days. She had skill to enliven our friend with all manner of diverting wiles. He felt in spirits such as he had not for many a month enjoyed. Since that shocking discovery had torn him from the side of Mariana, he had continued true to his vow to be on his guard against the encircling arms of woman, to avoid the faithless sex, to lock up his inclinations, his sweet wishes, in his own bosom. The conscientiousness with which he had observed this vow gave his whole nature a secret nourishment, and as his heart could not remain without affection, some loving sympathy had now become a want with him. He went along once more, as if environed by the first cloudy glories of youth, his eye fixed joyfully on every charming object, and never had his judgment of a lovely form been more favourable. How dangerous in such a situation this wild girl must have been to him is but too easy to conceive. Arrived at home, they found Wilhelm's chamber all ready to receive them, the chairs set right for a public reading, in the midst of them the table on which the punch-bowl was in due time to take its place. The German chivalry plays were new at this period, and had just excited the attention and the inclination of the public. Old Boisterous had brought one of this sort with him. The reading of it had already been determined on. They all sat down. Wilhelm took possession of the pamphlet and began to read. The harnessed knights, the ancient keeps, the true-heartedness, honesty, and downrightness, but especially the independence of the acting characters, were received with the greatest approbation. The reader did his utmost, and the audience gradually mounted into rapture. Between the third and fourth acts, the punch arrived in an ample bowl, and there being much fighting and drinking in the piece itself, nothing was more natural than that, on every such occurrence, the company should transport themselves into the situation of the heroes, should flourish and strike along with them, and drink long life to their favourites among the dramatis personae. Each individual of the party was inflamed with the noblest fire of national spirit. How it gratified this German company to be poetically entertained, according to their own character, on stuff of their own manufacture! In particular the vaults and caverns, the ruined castles, the moss and hollow trees, but above all the nocturnal gypsy scenes and the secret tribunal, produced a quite incredible effect. Every actor now figured to himself how, ere long, in helm and harness he, every actress how, with a monstrous spreading ruff she, would present their German ship before the public. Each would appropriate to himself without delay some name taken from the piece or from German history, and Madame Melina declared that the son or daughter she was then expecting should not be christened otherwise than by the name of Adalbert or of Matilda. Toward the fifth act, the approbation became more impetuous and louder. And at last, when the hero actually trampled down his oppressor, and the tyrant met his doom, the ecstasy increased to such a height that all averred that they had never passed such happy moments. Melina, whom the liquor had inspired, was the noisiest, and when the second bowl was emptied and midnight near, Laertes swore through thick and thin that no living mortal was worthy ever more to put these glasses to his lips. And so swearing, he pitched his own right over his head, through a window-pane, out into the street. The rest followed his example, and notwithstanding the protestations of the landlord, who came running in at the noise, the punch-bowl itself, never after this festivity to be polluted by unholy drink, was dashed into a thousand shreds. Felina, whose exhilaration was the least noticed, the other two girls by that time having laid themselves upon the sofa in no very elegant positions, maliciously encouraged her companions in their tumult. Madame Melina recited some spirit-stirring poems, and her husband, not too amiable in the uproar, began to cavil at the insufficient preparation of the punch, declaring that he could arrange an entertainment altogether in a different style, and at last becoming sulkier and louder as Laertes commanded silence, till the latter, without much consideration, threw the fragments of the punch-bowl about his head, and thereby not a little deepened the confusion. Meanwhile the town guard had arrived, and were demanding admission to the house. Wilhelm, much heated by his reading, though he had drunk but little, had enough to do, with the landlord's help, to content these people by money and good words, and afterward to get the various members of his party sent home in that unseemly case. On coming back, overpowered with sleep and full of chagrin, he threw himself upon his bed without undressing, and nothing could exceed his disgust when, opening his eyes next morning, he looked out with dull sight upon the devastations of the bygone day, and saw the uncleanness and the many bad effects of which that ingenious, lively, and well-intentioned poetical performance had been the cause. Chapter 11. After a short consideration, he called the landlord and bade him mark to his account both the damage and the regular charge. At the same time he learned, not without vexation, that his horse had been so hard ridden by Laertes last night that in all probability it was foundered, as they term it, the farrier having little hope of its recovering. A salute from Philina, which she threw him from her window, restored him in some degree to a more cheerful humour. He went forthwith into the nearest shop to buy her a little present, which in return for the powder knife he still owed her, and it must be owned that in selecting his gift he did not keep himself within the limits of proportional value. He not only purchased her a pair of earrings, but added likewise a hat and neckerchief, and some other little articles, which he had seen her lavishly throw from her on the first day of their acquaintance. Madame Melina, happening to observe him as he was delivering his presents, took an opportunity before breakfast to rate him very earnestly about his inclination for this girl, at which he felt the more astonished the less he thought it merited. He swore solemnly that he had never once entertained the slightest notion of attaching himself to such a person, whose whole manner of proceeding was well known to him. He excused himself as well as possible for his friendly and polite conduct towards her, yet did not by any means content Madame Melina, whose spite grew ever more determined, as she could not but observe that the flatteries, by which she had acquired for herself a sort of partial regard from our friend, were not sufficient to defend this conquest from the attacks of a lively, younger and more gifted rival. As they sat down to table, her husband joined them, likewise in a very fretful humour, which he was beginning to display on many little things, when the landlord entered to announce a player on the harp. "You will certainly," he said, "find pleasure in the music and the songs of this man. No one who hears him can forbear to admire him, and bestow something on him." "Let him go about his business," said Melina. "I am anything but in a trim for hearing fiddlers, and we have singers constantly among ourselves disposed to gain a little by their talent." He accompanied these words with a sarcastic side-look at Philina. She understood his meaning, and immediately prepared to punish him by taking up the cause of the harper. Turning toward Wilhelm, "Shall we not hear the man?" said she. "Shall we do nothing to save ourselves from this miserable ennui?" Melina was going to reply, and the strife would have grown keener had not the person it related to at that moment entered. Wilhelm saluted him, and beckoned him to come near. The figure of this singular guest set the whole party in astonishment. He had found a chair before any one took heart to ask him a question or make any observation. His bald crown was encircled by a few grey hairs, and a pair of large blue eyes looked out softly from beneath his long white eyebrows. To a nose of beautiful proportions was subjoined a flowing hoary beard, which did not hide the fine shape and position of his lips, and a long dark brown garment wrapped his thin body from the neck to the feet. He began to prelude on the harp, which he had placed before him. The sweet tones which he drew from his instrument very soon inspirited the company. "You can sing too, my good old man," said Philina. "Give us something that shall entertain the spirit and the heart as well as the senses," said Wilhelm. "The instrument should but accompany the voice, for tunes and melodies without words and meaning seem to me like butterflies or finely variegated birds, which hover round us in the air, which we could wish to catch and make our own, whereas song is like a blessed genius that exalts us toward heaven, and allures the better self in us to attend him." The old man looked at Wilhelm, then aloft, then gave some trills upon his harp, and began his song. It contained a eulogy on minstrelsy, described the happiness of minstrels, and reminded men to honour them. He produced his song with so much life and truth that it seemed as if he had composed it at the moment, for this special occasion. Wilhelm could scarcely refrain from clasping him in his arms, but the fear of awakening a peal of laughter detained him in his chair, for the rest were already in half-whispers making sundry very shallow observations, and debating if the harper was a papist or a Jew. When asked about the author of the song, the man gave no distinct reply, declaring only that he was rich in songs, and anxious that they should please. Most of the party were now merry and joyful. Even Melina was grown frank in his way, and whilst they talked and joked together, the old man began to sing the praise of social life in the most sprightly style. He described the loveliness of unity and courtesy in soft, soothing tones. Suddenly his music became cold, harsh, and jarring, as he turned to deplore repulsive selfishness, short-sighted enmity, and baleful division. And every heart willingly threw off those galling fetters, while, borne on the wings of a piercing melody, he launched forth in praise of peacemakers, and sang the happiness of souls that, having parted, meet again in love. Scarcely had he ended when Wilhelm cried to him, "Whoever thou art, that as a helping spirit comest to us with a voice which blesses and revives, accept my reverence and my thanks. Feel that we all admire thee, and confide in us if thou wantest anything." The old man spoke not. He threw his fingers softly across the strings, then struck more sharply, and sang. "What notes are those without the wall, across the portal sounding? Let's have the music in our hall, back from its roof rebounding." So spoke the king, the henchman flies, his answer heard, the monarch cries, "Bring in that ancient minstrel." "Hail, gracious king, each noble knight, each lovely dame, I greet you. What glittering stars salute my sight, what heart unmoved may meet you. Such lordly pomp is not for me, far other scenes my eyes must see, yet deign to list my harping." The singer turns him to his art, a thrilling strain he raises. Each warrior hears with glowing heart, and on his loved one gazes. The king, who liked his playing well, commands for such a kindly spell a golden chain be given him. "The golden chain give not to me, thy boldest knight may wear it, who cross the battle's purple sea, on lion breast may bear it. Or let it be thy chancellor's prize, amid his heaps to feast his eyes, its yellow glance will please him. I sing but as the linnet sings, that on the green bough dwelleth. A rich reward his music brings, as from his throat it swelleth. Yet might I ask, I'd ask of thine, one sparkling draught of purest wine, to drink it here before you." He viewed the wine, he quaffed it up, "O draught of sweetest savour! O happy house, where such a cup is thought a little favour! If well you fare, remember me, and thank kind heaven, from envy free, as now for this I thank you." When the harper, on finishing his song, took up a glass of wine that stood poured out for him, and turning with a friendly mien to his entertainers, drank it off, a buzz of joyful approbation rose from all the party. They clapped hands and wished him health from that glass, and strength to his aged limbs. He sang a few other ballads, exciting more and more hilarity among the company. "Old man," said Filina, "dost thou know the tune the shepherd decked him for the dance?" "Oh, yes," said he, "if you will sing the words, I shall not fail for my part of it." Filina then stood up and held herself in readiness. The old man commenced the tune, and she sang a song, which we cannot impart to our readers, lest they might think it insipid, or perhaps undignified. Meanwhile the company were growing merrier and merrier. They had already emptied several flasks of wine, and were now beginning to get very loud. But our friend, having fresh in his remembrance the bad consequences of their late exhilaration, determined to break up the sitting. He slipped into the old man's hand a liberal remuneration for his trouble. The rest did something likewise. They gave him leave to go and take repose, promising themselves another entertainment from his skill in the evening. When he had retired, our friend said to Filina, "In this favourite song of yours I certainly find no merit, either moral or poetical. Yet if you were to bring forward any proper composition on the stage, with the same arch simplicity, the same propriety and gracefulness, I should engage that strong and universal approbation would be the result." "Yes," said Filina, "it would be a charming thing indeed to warm oneself at ice." "After all," said Wilhelm, "this old man might put many a player to the blush. Did you notice how correctly the dramatic part of his ballads was expressed? I maintain there was more living, true representation in his singing than in many of our starched characters upon the stage. You would take the acting of many plays for a narrative, and you might ascribe to these musical narratives a sensible presence." "You are hardly just," replied Laertes. "I pretend to no great skill either as a player or as a singer, yet I know well enough that when music guides the movements of the body, at once affording to them animation and a scale to measure it, when declamation and expression are furnished me by the composer, I feel a quite different man from what I do when, in prose dramas, I have all this to create for myself, have both gesture and declamation to invent, and am perhaps disturbed in it too by the awkwardness of some partner in the dialogue." "Thus much I know," said Melina. "The man certainly puts us to the blush in one point, and that a main point. The strength of his talent is shown by the profit he derives from it. Even us, who perhaps ere long shall be embarrassed where to get a meal, he persuades to share our pittance with him. He has skill enough to wile the money from our pockets with an old song, the money that we should have used to find ourselves employment. So pleasant an affair is it to squander the means which might procure subsistence to oneself and others." This remark gave the conversation not the most delightful turn. Wilhelm, for whom the reproach was particularly intended, replied with some heat, and Melina, at no time over studious of delicacy and politeness, explained his grievances at last in words more plain than courteous. "It is now a fortnight," said he, "since we looked at the theatrical machinery and wardrobe which is lying pawned here. The whole might be redeemed for a very tolerable sum. You then gave me hopes that you would lend me so much, and hitherto I do not see that you have thought more of the matter, or come any nearer a determination. Had you then consented, we should ere now have been under way. Nor has your intention to leave the place been executed, nor has your money in the meantime been spared. At least there are people who have always skill to create opportunities for scattering it faster and faster away." Such upbraidings, not altogether undeserved, touched Wilhelm to the quick. He replied with keenness, nay, with anger, and as the company rose to part, he took hold of the door, and gave them not obscurely to understand that he would no longer continue with such unfriendly and ungrateful people. He hastened down in no kindly humour, and seated himself upon the stone bench without the door of his inn, not observing that, first out of mirth, then out of spleen, he had drunk more wine than usual. Chapter 12. After a short time, which he passed sitting looking out before him, disquieted by many thoughts, Filina came singing and skipping along through the front door. She sat down by him, nay, we might almost say on him, so close did she press herself toward him. She leaned upon his shoulders, began playing with his hair, patted him, and gave him the best words in the world. She begged of him to stay with them, and not leave her alone in that company, or she must die of tedium. She could not live any longer in the same house with Melina, and had come over to lodge in the other inn for that reason. He tried in vain to satisfy her with denials, to make her understand that he neither could nor would remain any longer. She did not cease with her entreaties. Nay, suddenly she threw her arm round his neck and kissed him with the liveliest expression of fondness. "Are you mad, Filina?" cried Wilhelm, endeavouring to disengage himself, "to make the open street the scene of such caresses, which I nowise merit. Let me go. I cannot and I will not stay." "And I will hold thee fast," said she, "and kiss thee here on the open street, and kiss thee till thou promise what I want." "I shall die of laughing," she continued. "By this familiarity the good people here must take me for thy wife of 4 weeks' standing, and husbands who witness this touching scene will commend me to their wives as a pattern of childlike simple tenderness." Some persons were just then going by. She caressed him in the most graceful way, and he, to avoid giving scandal, was constrained to play the part of the patient husband. Then she made faces at the people when their backs were turned, and in the wildest humour continued to commit all sorts of improprieties, till at last he was obliged to promise that he would not go that day, or the morrow, or the next day. "You are a true clod," said she, quitting him, "and I am but a fool to spend so much kindness on you." She arose with some vexation and walked a few steps, then turned round laughing and cried, "I believe it is just that, after all, that makes me so crazy about thee. I will but go and seek my knitting-needles and my stocking, that I may have something to do. Stay there, and let me find the stone man still upon the stone bench when I come back." She cast a sparkling glance on him, and went into the house. He had no call to follow her. On the contrary, her conduct had excited fresh aversion in him. Yet he rose from the bench to go after her, not well knowing why. He was just entering the door when Melina passed by, and spoke to him in a respectful tone, asking his pardon for the somewhat too harsh expressions he had used in their late discussion. "You will not take it ill of me," continued he, "if I appear perhaps too fretful in my present circumstances. The charge of providing for a wife, perhaps soon for a child, forbids me from day to day to live at peace, or spend my time, as you may do, in the enjoyment of pleasant feelings. Consider, I pray you, and, if possible, do put me in possession of that stage machinery that is lying here. I shall not be your debtor long, and I shall be obliged to you while I live." Our friend, unwilling to be kept upon the threshold, over which an irresistible impulse was drawing him at that moment to Filina, answered with an absent mind, eager to be gone, and surprised into a transient feeling of goodwill, "If I can make you happy and contented by doing this, I will hesitate no longer. Go you and put everything to rights. I shall be prepared this evening or tomorrow morning to pay the money." He then gave his hand to Melina in confirmation of his promise, and was very glad to see him hastily proceed along the street. But alas, his entrance, which he now thought sure, was a second time prohibited, and more disagreeably than at first. A young man with a bundle on his back came walking fast along the street, and advanced to Wilhelm, who at once recognised him for Friedrich. "Here am I again," cried he, looking with his large blue eyes joyfully up and down over all the windows of the house. "Where is Mamselle? Devil take me if I can stroll about the world any longer without seeing her." The landlord, joining them at this instant, replied that she was above. Friedrich, with a few bounds, was upstairs, and Wilhelm continued standing as if rooted to the threshold. At the first instant he was tempted to pluck the Junker back and drag him down by the hair. Then all at once the spasm of a sharp jealousy stopped the current of his spirits and ideas, and as he gradually recovered from this stupefaction, there came over him a splenetic fit of restlessness, a general discomfort, such as he had never felt in his life before. He went up to his room and found Mignon busy writing. For some time the creature had been labouring with great diligence in writing everything she knew by heart, giving always to her master and friend the papers to correct. She was indefatigable and of good comprehension, but still her letters were irregular and her lines crooked. Here too the body seemed to contradict the mind. In his usual moods Wilhelm took no small pleasure in the child's attention, but at the present moment he regarded little what she showed him, a piece of neglect which she felt the more acutely, as on this occasion she conceived her work had been accomplished with peculiar success. Wilhelm's unrest drove him up and down the passages of the house, and finally again to the street door. A rider was just prancing toward it, a man of good appearance, of middle age, and a brisk, contented look. The landlord ran to meet him, holding out his hand as to an old acquaintance. "Ay, Herr Stallmeister," cried he, "have we the pleasure to see you again?" "I am only just going to bait with you," replied the stranger, "and then along to the estate, to get matters put in order as soon as possible. The Count is coming over to-morrow with his lady. They mean to stay a while, to entertain the Prince von in their best style. He intends to fix his headquarters in this neighbourhood for some time." "It is pity," said the landlord, "that you cannot stop with us. We have good company in the house." The hostler came running out and took the horse from the Stallmeister, who continued talking in the door with the landlord, and now and then giving a look at Wilhelm. Our friend, observing that he formed the topic of their conversation, went away and walked up and down the streets. Chapter 13. In the restless vexation of his present humour, it came into his head to go and see the old harper, hoping by his music to scare away the evil spirits that tormented him. On asking for the man, he was directed to a mean public-house in a remote corner of the little town, and having mounted upstairs there to the very garret, his ear caught the fine twanging of the harp coming from a little room before him. They were heart-moving, mournful tones, accompanied by a sad and dreary singing. Wilhelm glided to the door, and as the good old man was performing a sort of voluntary, the few stanzas of which, sometimes chanted, sometimes in recitative, were repeated more than once, our friend succeeded, after listening for a while, in gathering nearly this: "Who never ate his bread with tears, through nights of grief, who, weeping, never sat on his bed midst pangs and fears, can, heavenly powers, not know you ever? Ye lead us forth into this life, where comfort soon by guilt is banished. Abandon us to tortures, strife, for on this earth all guilt is punished." Editor's Version. The heart-sick, plaintive sound of this lament pierced deep into the soul of the hearer. It seemed to him as if the old man were often stopped from proceeding by his tears. His harp would alone be heard for a time, till his voice again joined it in low, broken tones. Wilhelm stood by the door. He was much moved. The mourning of this stranger had again opened the avenues of his heart. He could not resist the claim of sympathy, or restrain the tears which this woebegone complaint at last called forth. All the pains that pressed upon his soul seemed now at once to loosen from their hold. He abandoned himself without reserve to the feelings of the moment. Pushing up the door, he stood before the harper. The old man was sitting on a mean bed, the only seat, or article of furniture, which his miserable room afforded. "What feelings thou hast awakened in me, good old man!" exclaimed he. "All that was lying frozen at my heart thou hast melted and put in motion. Let me not disturb thee, but continue, in solacing thy own sorrows, to confer happiness upon a friend." The harper was about to rise and say something, but Wilhelm hindered him, for he had noticed in the morning that the old man did not like to speak. He sat down by him on the straw bed. The old man wiped his eyes and asked with a friendly smile, "How came you hither? I meant to wait upon you in the evening again." "We are more quiet here," said Wilhelm. "Sing to me what thou pleasest, what accords with thy own mood of mind. Only proceed as if I were not by. It seems to me that to-day thou canst not fail to suit me. I think thee very happy that in solitude thou canst employ and entertain thyself so pleasantly, that being everywhere a stranger thou findest in thy own heart the most agreeable society." The old man looked upon his strings, and after touching them softly by way of prelude, he commenced and sang. "Who longs in solitude to live, ah, soon his wish will gain. Men hope and love, men get and give, and leave him to his pain. Yes, leave me to my moan, when from my bed you all are fled, I still am not alone. The lover glides with footstep light, his love, is she not waiting there? So glides to meet me day and night, in solitude my care, in solitude my woe. True solitude I then shall know, when lying in my grave, when lying in my grave, and grief has let me go." We might describe with great prolixity, and yet fail to express the charms of, the singular conversation which Wilhelm carried on with this wayfaring stranger. To every observation our friend addressed to him, the old man, with the nicest accordance, answered in some melody, which awakened all the cognate emotions, and opened a wide field to the imagination. Whoever has happened to be present at a meeting of certain devout people who conceive that in a state of separation from the church they can edify each other in a purer, more affecting, and more spiritual manner, may form to himself some conception of the present scene. He will recollect how the leader of the meeting would append to his words some verse of a song that raised the soul till, as he wished, she took wing. How another of the flock would ere long subjoin, in a different tune, some verse of a different song, and to this again a third would link some verse of a third song, by which means the kindred ideas of the songs to which the verses belonged were indeed suggested, yet each passage by its new combination became new and individualized, as if it had been first composed that moment. And thus from a well-known circle of ideas, from well-known songs and sayings, there was formed for that particular society, in that particular time, an original whole, by means of which their minds were animated, strengthened, and refreshed. So likewise did the old man edify his guest. By known and unknown songs and passages he brought feelings near and distant, emotions sleeping and awake, pleasant and painful, into a circulation from which, in Wilhelm's actual state, the best effects might be anticipated. Chapter 14. Accordingly, in walking back, he began to think with greater earnestness than ever on his present situation. He had reached home with the firm purpose of altering it, when the landlord disclosed to him, by way of secret, that Mademoiselle Filina had made a conquest of the Count's Stallmeister, who, after executing his commission at his master's estate, had returned in the greatest haste, and was even now partaking of a good supper with her up in her chamber. At that very moment Melina came in with the notary. They went into Wilhelm's chamber together, where the latter, though with some hesitation, made his promise good, gave a draft of 300 crowns to Melina, who, handing it to the lawyer, received in return a note acknowledging the sale of the whole theatrical apparatus, and engaging to deliver it next morning. Scarcely had they parted when Wilhelm heard a cry of horror rising from some quarter of the house. He caught the sound of a young voice uttering menacing and furious tones, which were ever and anon choked by immoderate weeping and howling. He observed this frantic noise move hastily from above, go past his door and down to the lower part of the house. Curiosity enticing our friend to follow it, he found Friedrich in a species of delirium. The boy was weeping, grinding his teeth, stamping with his feet, threatening with clenched fists. He appeared beside himself from fury and vexation. Mignon was standing opposite him, looking on with astonishment. The landlord, in some degree, explained this phenomenon. The boy, he said, being well received at his return by Filina, seemed quite merry and contented. He had kept singing and jumping about, till the time when Filina grew acquainted with the Stallmeister. Then, however, this half-grown Junker had begun to show his indignation, to slam the doors, and run up and down in the highest dudgeon. Filina had ordered him to wait at table that evening, upon which he had grown still sulkier and more indignant, till at last, carrying up a plate with a ragout, instead of setting it upon the table, he had thrown the whole between Mademoiselle and her guest, who were sitting moderately close together at the time, and the Stallmeister, after two or three hearty cuffs, had then kicked him out of the room. He, the landlord, had himself helped to clean both of them, and certainly their clothes had suffered much. On hearing of the good effect of his revenge, the boy began to laugh aloud, whilst the tears were still running down his cheeks. He heartily rejoiced for a time, till the disgrace which he had suffered from the stronger party once more came into his head, and he began afresh to howl and threaten. Wilhelm stood meditating and ashamed at this spectacle. It reflected back to him his own feelings, in coarser and exaggerated features. He too was inflamed with a fierce jealousy, and had not decency restrained him, he would willingly have satisfied his wild humour. With malicious spleen would have abused the object of his passion, and called out his rival. He could have crushed in pieces all the people round him. They seemed as if standing there but to vex him. Laertes also had come in and heard the story. He roguishly spurred on the irritated boy, who was now asserting with oaths that he would make the Stallmeister give him satisfaction, that he had never yet let any injury abide with him, that should the man refuse there were other ways of taking vengeance. This was the very business for Laertes. He went upstairs with a solemn countenance to call out the Stallmeister in the boy's name. "This is a pleasant thing," said the Stallmeister. "Such a joke as this I had scarcely promised myself tonight." They went down, and Filina followed them. "My son," said the Stallmeister to Friedrich, "thou art a brave lad, and I do not hesitate to fight thee. Only as our years and strength are unequal, and the attempt a little dangerous on that account, I propose a pair of foils in preference to other weapons. We can rub the buttons of them with a piece of chalk, and whoever marks upon the other's coat the first or the most thrusts shall be held the victor, and be treated by the other with the best wine that can be had in town." Laertes decided that the proposition might be listened to. Friedrich obeyed him as his tutor. The foils were produced. Filina took a seat, went on with her knitting, and looked at the contending parties with the greatest peace of mind. The Stallmeister, who could fence very prettily, was complacent enough to spare his adversary, and to let a few chalk scores be marked upon his coat, after which the two embraced, and wine was ordered. The Stallmeister took the liberty of asking Friedrich's parentage and history, and Friedrich told him a long story, which had often been repeated already, and which at some other opportunity we purpose communicating to our readers. To Wilhelm, in the meantime, this contest completed the representation of his own state of mind. He could not but perceive that he would willingly have taken up a foil against the Stallmeister. A sword, still more willingly, though evidently much his inferior in the science of defence. Yet he deigned not to cast one look on Filina. He was on his guard against any word or movement that could possibly betray his feelings, and after having once or twice done justice to the health of the duellists, he hastened to his own room, where a thousand painful thoughts came pressing round him. He called to memory the time when his spirit, rich in hope and full of boundless aims, was raised aloft, and encircled with the liveliest enjoyments of every kind as with its proper element. He now clearly saw that of late he had fallen into a broken, wandering path, where, if he tasted, it was but in drops what he once quaffed in unrestricted measure. But he could not clearly see what insatiable want it was that nature had made the law of his being, and how this want had been only set on edge, half satisfied and misdirected by the circumstances of his life. It will not surprise us, therefore, that in considering his situation and labouring to extricate himself, he fell into the greatest perplexity. It was not enough that by his friendship for Laertes, his attachment to Filina, his concern for Mignon, he had been detained longer than was proper in a place and a society where he could cherish his darling inclination, content his wishes, as it were, by stealth, and without proposing any object, again pursue his early dreams. These ties he believed himself possessed of force enough to break asunder. Had there been nothing more to hold him, he could have gone at once. But only a few moments ago he had entered into money transactions with Melina. He had seen that mysterious old man, the enigma of whose history he longed with unspeakable desire to clear. Yet of this too, after much balancing of reasons, he at length determined, or thought he had determined, that it should not keep him back. "I must go." He threw himself into a chair. He felt greatly moved. Mignon came in and asked whether she might help to undress him. Her manner was still and shy. It had grieved her to the quick to be so abruptly dismissed by him before. Nothing is more touching than the first disclosure of a love which has been nursed in silence, of a faith grown strong in secret, and which at last comes forth in the hour of need and reveals itself to him who formerly has reckoned it of small account. The bud, which had been closed so long and firmly, was now ripe to burst its swathings, and Wilhelm's heart could never have been readier to welcome the impressions of affection. She stood before him and noticed his disquietude. "Master," she cried, "if thou art unhappy, what will become of Mignon?" "Dear little creature," said he, taking her hands, "thou too art part of my anxieties. I must go hence." She looked at his eyes, glistening with restrained tears, and knelt down with vehemence before him. He kept her hands. She laid her head upon his knees and remained quite still. He played with her hair, patted her, and spoke kindly to her. She continued motionless for a considerable time. At last he felt a sort of palpitating movement in her, which began very softly, and then by degrees, with increasing violence, diffused itself all over her frame. "What ails thee, Mignon?" cried he. "What ails thee?" She raised her little head, looked at him, and all at once laid her hand upon her heart, with the countenance of one repressing the utterance of pain. He raised her up, and she fell upon his breast. He pressed her toward him, and kissed her. She replied not by any pressure of the hand, by any motion whatever. She held firmly against her heart, and all at once gave a cry, which was accompanied by spasmodic movements of the body. She started up, and immediately fell down before him, as if broken in every joint. It was an excruciating moment. "My child," cried he, raising her up and clasping her fast, "my child, what ails thee?" The palpitations continued, spreading from the heart over all the lax and powerless limbs. She was merely hanging in his arms. All at once she again became quite stiff, like one enduring the sharpest corporeal agony, and soon with a new vehemence all her frame once more became alive, and she threw herself about his neck, like a bent spring that is closing, while in her soul, as it were, a strong rent took place, and at the same moment a stream of tears flowed from her shut eyes into his bosom. He held her fast. She wept, and no tongue can express the force of these tears. Her long hair had loosened, and was hanging down before her. It seemed as if her whole being was melting incessantly into a brook of tears. Her rigid limbs were again become relaxed. Her inmost soul was pouring itself forth. In the wild confusion of the moment, Wilhelm was afraid she would dissolve in his arms, and leave nothing there for him to grasp. He held her faster and faster. "My child," cried he, "my child, thou art indeed mine, if that word can comfort thee. Thou art mine. I will keep thee. I will never forsake thee." Her tears continued flowing. At last she raised herself. A faint gladness shone upon her face. "My father," cried she, "thou wilt not forsake me. Wilt be my father? I am thy child." Softly at this moment the harp began to sound before the door. The old man brought his most affecting songs as an evening offering to our friend, who, holding his child ever faster in his arms, enjoyed the most pure and undescribable felicity. End of section 6.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.